This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
First of all, thank you very much to Margot and the National Museum for inviting me to not only this symposium today, but also to participate in the one in Tokyo. It was a fantastic experience, particularly for an art historian, to be there at the coalface, looking at the impact of the reception of contemporary Indigenous art in a place like Japan, and to sort of hear what people were saying. If this wasn't complex ground enough, that made it a great deal more complex. I have to say, just in that regard, another aspect of a Eurocentric perspective was brought home to me, because I know that we were, colleagues and I were very enthusiastic and eager to hear a Japanese perspective of contemporary Indigenous art. And we were imagining all kinds of things about calligraphy and, a completely what now is a Eurocentric idea of contemporary Japanese people about the way that they would engage with the art. And, of course, modernism has such a long history and a very sophisticated, people have a very sophisticated practice and education and knowledge of modernism in Japan, that, of course, they were engaging with the art in quite similar ways to us. And it possibly will be in a few more years where that becomes quite more complex and different to Australia. But it was interesting, I think, getting back to this issue of modernism, about how non-European modernism is. It's not something that is owned by Europe at all. Partly that's part of my paper. But it's not a paper either. It's a ramble, so I'll try not to ramble too long. I'd also just like to digress very quickly to acknowledge what I heard last night, the concept of Margot the Magnificent. As someone who did work with Margot on the very first Emily exhibition, I just want to make note of what an extraordinary effort getting an exhibition like this together takes. I think that people ought to be aware of the logistics that go behind these things, and the bureaucratic politics of between art institutions and anthropological or museums, etc. The politics between art dealers, the politics between Aboriginal people and whitefellas, the politics within the Aboriginal community. It was an unbelievable experience to see Margot navigate her way through that. And I haven't even got to the politics of Enware herself, someone who produced over 3,000 works of variable quality but also variable genius. How do you sort that out? How do you select it? It's very easy now to look at this and start to sort of, make some sense of it. But Margot had nothing. She had one huge problem and all these artworks, and she had some very good connections and some very good advice, but it was one of the most extraordinary things that I've ever seen, and I mean that, and it put me off curating for quite some time. And I'm really not over it yet, but I do want to acknowledge, I think that Margot is an extraordinary figure in art history, and she will be written about by art historians and for her role in not only just in Ware, but in this whole cross-cultural art history in times to come. So take a bow, Margot. I also just want to make a brief comment and reiterate some things that people have said earlier. But it's important to remember that Utopia as a name is not ironic. And I've been to Utopia on quite a few occasions, and it is a beautiful landscape. It is full of colour, full of variety. There's lush green vegetation that bursts into massive, vibrant colour of wildflowers. The sunsets and sunrises are beyond belief. And in fact, in the Holmes Accord publication, Utopia, A Picture Story, Anne-Marie Brody writes the history of how it was named Utopia by a couple of pastoralists or would-be pastoralists who ended up calling it the Utopia Pastoral Station because they'd come via the Simpson Desert, which really is quite barren, and they came to Utopia, which did appear in that context as a utopia. And I think this is important to remember because it's Enwire's work is about a visual reference to that country, and it's her admiration of a natural beauty, a spectacular natural beauty, which is something I think that is possibly universal. You know, we all respond to natural beauty, and if there's something there in that, the way she's using colour and the certain sensations of light, etc., you know, if anything's universal, I think the sense of the love of her for a spectacularly beautiful country surely does come through to us in some sense. However, the argument I'm putting forward here is in fact not a universalist argument at all. It's attempting to look at Enwire's relationship with modernity, trying to understand her engagement with modernity and modernism in some sense, as is provoked by the title of this symposium. I want to argue initially that the modernist aesthetic is not new to Emily Enwire when she starts painting at all. And I'll go through the process here, but there's a whole history of Aboriginal image making since European contact in Central Australia that is part of Enwire's aesthetic, just as her Aboriginal experience inside and background. And I'll tease that out as I go. But in an Aboriginal, we know that in Unmudra and in an Aboriginal worldview, there is no specific term for art, basically because art is interconnected with all aspects of their life. And so they don't actually have this discrete term art. But therefore, nor do they have the discrete distinction between art and craft. So when there's craft making going on in Central Australia, it's image making, it's mark making in an Aboriginal worldview. Emily Enwire lived in Central Australia for most of the 20th century. And the Central Australian Aboriginal community are not isolated little communities. They're, as far as gossips go and people talking about what other people are doing, they're among the best in the world. So they know what's going on. You know, Utopia knows what's going on with Pijindara people, Warrawee people. You know, there's an ethos of minding your own business, but few people do it. So to say that Enwire is a person who, you know, she has no knowledge of modernism, modernist aesthetic or modernity, is to deny the real-life history of living in Central Australia as an Aboriginal person in the 20th century. And in fact, more than saying that why Enwire is a genius because she paints the whole lot of Alalkara, I would say she's a genius because she paints the whole history of Alalkara in the 20th century. She brings a history of contact plus a deep insight of Anamantara culture, Analua culture, into her art in a way that's realised and resolved that is just simply extraordinary. And as fellow Australians who've lived in the 20th century, part of that history is also our history. You know, we may not have gone to Utopia, we may not have gone to Central Australia, but particularly in terms of aesthetics, design aesthetics and things that are going around, you know, about Aboriginality but simply about, you know, different tastes and trends, we both live in the same world. And I would argue that Enwire is not totally isolated from that at all. And I just want to go through why. The device or the vehicle that I want to talk about this is in terms of the concept of ritual. And I'm arguing that the concept of ritual is the vehicle for change in contemporary Aboriginal art. We conventionally look at the term ritual and don't actually use it much in contemporary art history because it has a connotation of, you know, a static repetition of something from the past. But in fact, I think that when you look at the way ritual is brought to bear on contemporary Aboriginal art, you can see that it is a dynamic vehicle for change. It's how they move through and engage the modern world in the 20th century. Now, in terms of the function of ritual in a pre-contact Aboriginal culture, and I'm generalising here, but certainly the idea of a ritual ceremony or what have you was that it was a big event. And there's all sorts of ritual, but I'm using ceremony here to start with. A ceremony was a big event that brought together the interconnectedness of all aspects of life. And this is one of the fundamental tenets of an Aboriginal worldview. It's how you make sense of the world. You find the interconnectedness between all things. And you kind of, you know, you have a dreaming story for it, or you understand country as my body, the reason why the stars are in the sky, the reason why, you know, my brother is my brother and why I shouldn't speak to my mother-in-law, etc. It's that interconnectedness. And these ritual ceremonies, these huge performance events, bringing together dance, song, body painting, ground painting, painted weapons, dreaming stories, an entire collected wisdom of your community, was a way in an oral culture to remember that important collected wisdom. They don't write it down in books, but they remember it, and they remember it in a very specific way. So these ritual performances were the framework for maintaining not only a body of knowledge about the interconnectedness and the interrelated relevance of all aspects of your life, but also for making sense and creating meaning for new things that come into your life. And basically it's what when they say keeping the dreaming alive, keeping it relevant, regenerating it, keeping it active, keeping it making those connections, making sense of the world. We all understand how we have a framework to make sense of the world. We have different frameworks. In their framework, this interconnectedness is extremely important. And I believe that they use the concept of ritual in Aboriginal art to maintain that interconnectedness, but also to connect themselves into the modern era, into modernism or modernity, into a world where now white fellas, for better or worse as far as they're concerned, are a part of their world. So rather than Aboriginal culture being modernised, I want to suggest that Aboriginal artists ritualise modernity. So I'm just shifting it for a moment, and you can attack me for saying, well, you're just trying to, you know, speak from an Aboriginal perspective. You're not Aboriginal. How can you do that? And I accept that. Yes, I don't know enough to say that I can speak from an Aboriginal perspective at all. But as an art historian, I sometimes think, you know, hey, I don't really know what it's like to walk in the shoes of a, you know, psychotically affected Dutchman of the late 19th century. But it doesn't stop me having a go at talking about what Van Gogh might have been about. Sure, it's part of a European tradition, but at the end of the day, that man's life and that man's world is pretty far distant from mine. But, you know, it's this idea that there's an active communication here and there's something going on. And at the end of the day, Emily Nwaré, her history, her time, and the political issues particularly that were going on are much closer to me than Van Gogh's context. So, yes, I'm trying to look at an Aboriginal perspective of the relationship between her art and modernity, but I think that it, in some sense, it's reasonably valid. The images that I have up there just simply show a lineage between the movement from Aboriginal ritual to contemporary art that we're fairly familiar with. In terms of Papunya, we've got the original ground paintings, these wonderfully that magnificent three-dimensional performance works of art where all of the beautiful materials from country, the ochres, the feathers, the all sorts of different coloured ochres, etc., are made into these huge ground paintings. Beautiful poles are painted, and in relationship to whatever ritual dreaming was being performed, people would paint up similarly and sing songs and relate, and that would be a completely interconnected body of knowledge related to that ground painting. And, of course, when the Papunya painters first get an opportunity to paint on canvas, they actually paint in an idiom that I would argue that is much more akin to the idiom that they were used to of, I'll just move forward for a moment, of poker art or making images of Aboriginal culture on souvenirs, which had been going on for decades prior to this. And there'd been a substantial economy in making images for white fellas via this. And remember, I'm saying there's no clear distinction between art and craft in an Aboriginal worldview. So, you know, making images, and this is a first kind of connection for a culture that was being assimilated and being told, stop being Aboriginal. If you want to survive, just behave like white fellas. Don't use language, don't use your culture, don't make those images. You know, stay away. However, as souvenirs, we wouldn't mind a few images on your objects, thanks. So it's like it's this window of opportunity. And many Aboriginal people in Central Australia participated in this kind of image making. And it's a first connection. It's one of these interconnections. White fellas are prepared to have a look at this. They're interested in image making of Aboriginal culture in this way. And it would be difficult to say that Enwari would be totally ignorant of that entire trade that was going on in Central Australia. Similarly with Albert Namatjira, Namatjira's recognition throughout the Aboriginal community is something that is yet to be written about. It's a piece of art history that really needs to be researched. I say that because I know that the Mornington Island artist Dick Ruffsey, in his own autobiography, wrote when he first met Percy Tresize, and he comes from Mornington Island in the Gulf of Carpentaria. He went up to him and he said, hey, I want to be the next Namatjira. You know, teach me how to paint. And Tresize says, well, you know, stick with bark painting for a while and you can, you know, we'll see how it goes. But it's just the presence of Namatjira in the Aboriginal world as someone who's successfully negotiated these connections with the white fellow world was immense. And the other thing that Namatjira does that we understand now more than we did at the time was that in an Aboriginal worldview, it's an acceptance of innovation and creativity. Aboriginal art has never been created in this way ever before. But he gets recognised by white fellas. He gets hailed, becomes the first citizen, Aboriginal citizen. You know, to say this does not have impact on Aboriginal people is to deny them any intelligence whatsoever. And he's being creative and innovative. As white fellas, we sort of see him at one stage as being a product of assimilation. Ooh, he's Aboriginal, but geez, he sold out. He started painting like a white fella. And when we get to a post-colonial era, we get very uncomfortable about that. Aboriginal people, particularly Aranda people at Holmesburg, never had any problem with that. We forgot to ask them. Have you got a problem with what he's doing? No. Why? Because he was keeping the dreaming alive. He was sustaining some visual image-making about his relationship with this country, his love of this country, his connections, his interconnectedness, at a time when it just wasn't happening in any other way. They understood that to the point that today, if you go to Hermannsburg and say, could you show me your traditional art? They show you watercolour painting. That's their tradition. They totally believe that as their tradition. Sure, you know, Namatjira, old man Albert, he invented the style of watercolour painting taken from white fellas. Doesn't matter. It's performing a function in this ritual of interconnections between all aspects of life. and recognition from white fellas, an acceptance that we have a culture, is a very, very important aspect of that interconnected philosophy of life in the 20th century, at a time when there was almost something that we could call cultural genocide. It's there fighting back against that. So art stroke image making is going circulating in this souvenir market. It's circulating via the recognition and the fame of Albert Namatjira, but also, as is very well recorded in many of the books about Emily Omwuare, and again, particularly the Holmes & Court publication, Utopia, A Picture Story, there's also, since the early, well, I might have even started in the late 1960s, but certainly during the 1970s, there's the printmaking and Aboriginal art and craft initiatives that arose in response to Aboriginal communities being successful in land claims. So, and Utopia is a perfect example. Aboriginal people regain freehold title of their land. They're back on country, they have ownership of their country, and it's kind of now what? And they're looking for economic self-sufficiency initiatives. And art and craft making is seen as one of those initiatives. So, and the Australian government was very vigorous in funding that Aboriginal art and craft initiative in Central Australia. So people like Jenny Green, who was one of the first people to teach batik in, and again, Emily participated in batik making. Julia Murray, or there's, you know, a long history of people who came into the Utopia community and taught them how the actual technique of batik printing. However, they used that technique in order to express their own Indigenous culture. Now, the point I want to make here about modernity is that there is something about fabric painting and design that is a highly modernist in essence. There's a sense of all-over design. If you think about it, as an artist who has no history of what an artwork is in terms of our point of reference, that it has a frame and you create an image inside it, and it all relates to the frame, as Clement Greenberg tells us endlessly. If you don't have that idea, and art can be a souvenir or a scene that Albert does, or traditional iconography or batik painting or what have you, the idea that when you get a piece of fabric and you do an all-over design and you do repetitive motifs that interlap and you pay attention to flatness and you know, a kind of ongoing, continuous aesthetic, this must have a large impact on when they come to canvas painting. I'll get onto it a bit more. There's the images there are simply some of the designs. There's a wonderful exhibition that was on at the Powerhouse in Sydney of Aboriginal textiles, which again I think is going to reinvigorate the history of textile aesthetics in Central Australia and other areas, and the impact on, you know, a so-called accidental modernism when they start canvas painting. I don't think so. I think they've had a long history of a certain kind of modernist tendency on a flat surface that when they come to a canvas painting, it's like, okay, I'm going to... And there's, you know, a great deal of Emily's work is a very all-over painting, colour field painting. The essence of colour theory in design, it translates into canvas painting magnificently. And I'm pretty sure it might be Christopher Hodges, correct me if I'm wrong, writes in one of the books on Utopia about how the batik making fits perfectly into ritual activities that would have, you know, taken place in Unmadjara communities prior to contact. The idea of sitting around a hubcap full of molten wax and with the fabric across your knees, moving the fabric across as you paint your design. Again, think of all-over aesthetic and what that sort of imprint it has on people. yarning, talking to each other, talking about the stories that you're painting. Here in the middle, we've got Emily singing The Emu Dreaming and clapping as she's just finished the batik that's in the show. Yeah, the batik that's in the exhibition. And so here, this kind of ritualisation of modernity. Sure, there's a modernist aesthetic happening. There's an influence of external techniques and everything. But there's a ritual activity there that, in some sense, is ritualising modernity, absorbing it and appropriating it into their way of life, making the connections between the way they see the world. It's them making sense of modernity. Why? Because it's in their face. Of course they're going to make sense of it. Anything that's come into their lives in the entire, you know, history of Aboriginal culture, they've made sense of it. They've philosophised over it. Similarly with body painting. Again, there's been extensive writing about how when they first came to canvas painting, it was suggested that the women translate body paintings into canvas. And the first efforts were quite figurative. But again, figurative art has a long history. It goes back to these figurative elements that were on the souvenirs. They've already been doing figurative art in a Western sense for a long time. So there's, and similarly with the first Papunya paintings were very figurative. We've got a very good visual representation in that centre one there of the body painting, the headgear, the designs for the poles, the designs that would be on the ground painting. In fact, they were so representational that it caused a great ruckus in the Central Australian community because they realised that secret, sacred knowledge was potentially being disseminated across different Aboriginal communities. So it wasn't secret, sacred knowledge being provided to white fellas because, let's face it, we wouldn't have a clue if it was standing right in front of us whether it's secret, sacred, and they know that. But they do know that there are women who shouldn't look at men's business and children who are not initiated, who shouldn't look at, you know, initiated material, etc. And when this art started circulating in Central Australia, they had to renegotiate that aesthetic, bring it back into its proper ritual. So we then get the development of the more abstract, but still in some sense very literal depictions of ceremony. And that's an early Johnny Warren Cooler where you can still see the ceremonial figure on the far right, and you can see a great deal of the emblems that were being much more specific in the 1970-71 paintings. And where, as true artists, as Christopher says, you know, great artists are great artists. They are people who have visual solutions for conceptual problems. That's what an artist is. And, you know, they're faced with this problem, A, how to represent ground paintings on a two-dimensional surface, and then B, how to reveal and conceal secret, sacred knowledge at once. We want to show we have a sophisticated culture. We want people to know that there's secret bodies of knowledge that are important to us, but we can't reveal it entirely. So you get this aesthetic dialectic, the dotting over, the you know, showing something in a... and a visual ambiguity, if you like, of reveal and conceal. Magnificent artistic solutions to a conceptual problem. Great artists. And Inwari, of course, is one of those. This is the Mornington Island artists where... the original body paintings that were used in ritual ceremonies originally were translated onto bark at the request of anthropologists who wanted traditional, authentic examples of this aesthetic. So they asked people to paint in ochres using the ochres and feathers that they had on the body painting and putting it onto... onto bark, and there was very much a sense, well, this is traditional because it's the traditional materials, but, you know, the actual separate discrete object of a bark painting is not traditional at all. It was the walls of huts. They didn't actually make a bark painting as such. It's a post-contact concept. But in a Eurocentric way, we tend to look at that as being more traditional than what the development of this art goes along. So the more schematic paring down in acrylic on canvas, and then increasingly into what we see again as a greater degree of abstraction, yet nevertheless containing these very literal references back to the ritual itself. How am I going for time? Winding up? Okay. So with Enware, I'm simply arguing that she has this unbelievable ability to maintain the ritual. When she first starts painting, looks very, very abstract. We've got the grevillea fowl, we've got the body painting, we've got the little emu's foot up the top. Again, it's this inscription of a wulya, whole lot. And in some sense, I think whole lot means interconnectedness. I'm doing what the ritual always does. I'm interconnecting my awulya, my alalkra, my emu dreaming, but I'm interconnecting it with the modern world, with a reception of white fellas, using the history that I have of souvenir market, creativity and innovation impressed upon us by the recognition of Albert Namatjira, and an entire design aesthetic via batik making that, she would have been imbibing the entire time. And is that it? Shall I finish? Yes. Okay. I just want to also mention the how there's a... I think the really exciting thing about the abstraction of Enware is that it really does bring a new language of abstraction to us. The idea that it's utterly abstract, yet there's this incredible literal referencing, as in the emu painting I just showed, but also I was struck speechless by the rock art that I was shown a photograph of, which is, this is on the far left, Lindsay Bird Pichari, who's Emily's nephew, so it's Alalkara country here. But this is a large waterhole on Alalkara, and inside the lip of that is rock art that Lindsay was there showing the person who took the photograph. And I know, it's, white fella misunderstanding, maybe, but this rock art of these beautiful abstract lines and Emily's painting, I mean, it's if that's a coincidence, well, so be it. But I think that, to me, it's why this is Aboriginal art before it's abstraction. But, yes, it's both. It's a creative genius who's brought all of that together from an experience over the 20th century, which I think is just extraordinary. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.